Today is Wednesday, February 4th, 2015, and I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We do not have any committee legislative concepts to propose for adoption today, so we will not be opening a work session. But I do want to remind you that if you have any bills that you would like this committee to consider as a committee bill, please bring it to me. We will continue to have this on the possible agenda every day until we hit the deadline. And now I'd like to open an informational meeting, and I call Megan Irwin, David Mandel, and Rhonda Przinski to come tell us about early childhood. I'll just say while you're settling in that we just came, three of us are serving together on the House Healthcare Committee, and we ended up that committee with, a fantastic presentation by Tony Biglin, who's a PhD researcher on evidence-based interventions to really help youth from prenatal, their prenatal stages all the way through adolescence and a little beyond, and the kind of interventions that DHS does a lot of. And so we are starting, in terms of that being kind of a roadmap, starting right on the early end. All of the ages and different groups that we deal with here in the Human Services and Housing Committee are really, really important to their families, their loved ones in the state of Oregon. And I'm passionate about all of them, but I'm particularly passionate about early childhood, and it's a good place to start. So thank you for starting us off.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director, and we are really excited to be here to talk with you and share some information today. Today we're here to talk about child care, which is an absolutely critical part of our early learning system and our system of support for working families in this state. It's a real pleasure for me to be here today with my colleague David Mandel, who works at the Early Learning Division with me, as well as our colleague Rhonda Przinski, who we partner with very closely at the Department of Human Services. So today, as I said, we've been asked to provide an overview of Oregon's child care system and policy. So I'm going to do a pretty brief overview of the state's sort of overarching policy vision and work around child care, and talk a little bit about the role of the Early Learning Division in that work. Hand it over to David, who will go into a bit more detail on the early learning education side of child care, and then hand it over to Rhonda, who's going to talk about the self-sufficiency side of our work on child care.
Can I ask you one thing?
Sure.
As you go, each of you go through this, do you want to be interrupted by questions as you go through it, or should we wait to the end of each of you speaking?
You know, Chair Kenny Geyer, I prefer to how you would prefer to run your committee. We've been given an hour, so we were going to try to be brief in our comments so that we would have time for questions, but I'm really happy to just take questions as they occur to folks and have more of a conversation as long as my colleagues are comfortable with that as well.
Great. Yeah. Let's start that way, and I'll move us along if it looks like we're spending 45 minutes on just you.
Sure. Hopefully we won't do that just because the information these folks have is really vital.
Yeah.
So the first thing I'm going to do is just briefly orient you to where the division sits structurally in this work. And for me, all of that starts from our mission. So the mission of the Early Learning Division is to support Oregon's young children and families to learn and to thrive. And as you'll see over the course of our discussion today, strong support for child care and strong support for working families is central to our ability to achieve that mission. Statutorily, the Early Learning Division was created in 2013 with a mandate to ensure that all children arrive at school prepared for kindergarten. And in addition to that clear point of accountability, we were also given three high-level goals that are also laid out in statute for the division and our governing body, the Early Learning Council. And the council is the policy body that oversees our work, including policy creation, rule promulgation, and program implementation. And so you can see the goals that the division holds here on the screen. All of our work relates back to these three goals, and what we're talking about today, child care support and child care policy, is central to both children arriving at kindergarten ready to succeed and making sure that families are healthy, stable, and attached. this just really quickly orients you to where we sit inside the Department of Education. The takeaway here from this kind of hard to look at slide is that by situating ourselves inside of the department, I think we're sending a really clear signal about the educational value and the importance of high quality early learning and development programs, which is something that I'm sure the members of this committee understand, but I'm not sure that that's always something that's been so explicitly laid out. So having childcare as part of the Department of Education sends a really important signal about how important it is for children's learning and development. So this slide is one of the takeaways from our presentation today. In our work, we think of childcare as a really critical two-generational investment. First, it is an investment in families. It's absolutely necessary for working families. Without childcare, families can't work. And yet, at the same time, their choices are often really constrained. They're constrained by what they can afford, what's near their homes, what fits within the cultural norms and values of their community, constrained by their linguistic needs. And then families are also looking for childcare environments that are nurturing and will be developmental and educational environments. And then, on top of all of that, they're looking for childcare environments that are open when they need to send their kids to care for work. And trying to find childcare that does all of those things causes real stress for families. And in Oregon, 70% of our investment in childcare and early learning and development programs comes right out of the pockets of working families. It's a market-based system. So investing in early childcare is really important in terms of reaching our goals related to family stability in our early learning system. And then childcare also matters for children. It's where the kids under five in our state show up the most. There are over 230,000 children under the age of five in our state. Only 15,000 of them are in publicly funded preschool programs. 137,000 of them are in some kind of formal or informal childcare. The rest are just at home with their parents. And so we think that one of our best opportunities for reaching that 137,000 children who are in childcare and supporting them to reach our goals around school readiness is to really dig in and focus on childcare as early learning and development programs and focus on the quality of those programs, which David's going to dig into a little bit later. This just takes you one level, slight level deeper. I won't belabor it too much, but you can see here what some of the actual programmatic supports look like. So on the support for families side, the Department of Human Services runs the employment-related daycare program, which helps low-income families purchase childcare. On the early learning division side, it's our responsibility to license childcare to basic health and safety standards, to provide professional development for childcare providers, and then to invest in quality so that we're building childcare environments where early learning and development are happening on purpose. I won't belabor this slide again because I think that this committee really understands why early experiences matter so much, but I can't give a presentation on early childhood education without emphasizing that the developing brain is the most sensitive to learning early in life, and that the quality of early interactions with adults and caregivers matters most in the early years, and that this is a really critical thing for us to be investing in. While I've been emphasizing childcare for the purposes of this presentation, I do want to point out that this brain building that the previous slide highlights happens in all kinds of settings. It happens in Head Start and school-based preschool, childcare centers, home-based family care providers, and of course at home with the family. And in our work at the division, we do understand that if we want to have an early learning system that's truly focused on the needs of families and children, we have to be prepared to support them in whichever setting they choose, although today we are focusing really heavily on childcare. And then finally, this graphic just drives that home point, that point home further and shows you where children are at under the age of five before they enter school. A large portion are only with parents. The rest are in early learning development programs like childcare, licensed childcare, and formal pre-kindergarten programs. The rest are in informal care, which you may sometimes hear called family, friends, and neighbors care. So that is the overview I was going to do. I'll take questions, and then we'll hop over to David.
I thought you might want to say something more about Oregon Pre-K. It's a connection to Head Start.
Sure. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, in Oregon, we have a preschool program called the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start Program. And it's called that because they're one and the same, and the state of Oregon actually invests more in Head Start than the federal government does, which we're proud of. It's just one part of our early learning system, but it's an important one.
Here in the next slide, we actually have a little information.
Aha, uh-huh. And David tells me on the next slide where he's picking up to drive. He has more information on the specifics of the programs that we run.
Chair Kenny Geyer, committee members, for the record, I'm David Mandel, the Director of Policy and Research at the Early Learning Division, and it's just truly a great pleasure to have this opportunity to be here before this committee to talk about the work of the division and talk about child care, a crucial support for working families and a vital part of our early learning system. This is truly true generational work. It's about supporting both children and the adults who take care of them. Today, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit more about the programs that the Early Learning Division runs, like Oregon Pre-Kindergarten, our role in child care, and initiatives that we're taking to promote quality early learning environments. And then I'm going to end with some important changes to federal rules that are going to impact our work around child care. So I think particularly since the Early Learning Division is really quite new, I also just wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the other programs that the division runs. Megan already talked to you a little bit about Oregon Pre-Kindergarten, our unique collaboration with the Federal Head Start Program to provide preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds living in families in poverty. And through state funding, we serve about 7,500 children a year. At this point, that's a little over than 50% of the eligible children. We also run Healthy Families Oregon, a home visiting program that really focuses the sort of birth to three population, helping parents develop both the health and child development skills to promote the well-being of their children. We support the relief nurseries, Oregon really homegrown model of respite care and family services that's really designed to prevent the cycle of child maltreatment. And we have about 15 core centers and 10 satellite centers in the state now. And also we have our child care supports. So we play a major role through our licensing. And,
mm-hmm. Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about Head Start, and I don't know if you're going to go back to it later.
So this would be a good time if you have additional questions.
Good. Because in setting the stage for why we're spending a lot of time on child care and ERDC, I want to say I went through a learning process where I thought, okay, if you're eligible, if you're low income, then you get Head Start, and that takes care of it. And through many years of being involved in this work, I realized how limited that program is. So Head Start is very comprehensive. There's home visiting as part of it. There's a lot of really great things about Head Start, but it's only for families up to, I think it's 100% of the free and reduced, the poverty line. And as you said, only 50% of those that are eligible actually get to take part in it. And another thing that was a huge wake-up call to me is that in most cases, it's considered an enrichment program. It's really not an answer for working families because it's 3 days a week, 4 hours a day, 9 months a year, unless there's some additional funding. There are some places that can make it, stretch it into a full time, but that's not the starting model. And so for when we think about how do we help low-income families break out of poverty and get ready to thrive in kindergarten, you can't just say, oh, Head Start is the answer, anyone who's eligible. So serves a very, very small part of the population. And then when you go over 100%, the minute you start actually earning a real income, you are no longer eligible for it, which is why we're going to look at how do you support families who are really trying to, earn a living. How do we support them? And so I just wanted to point that out. The other thing, and please correct me on anything because I might be going on old information, the other piece of the Head Start is the early Head Start for the 0- to 3-year-olds, which is, of course, a lot more expensive because of the ratios that you need when you take care of smaller kids. And as I recall, we only were serving something like 3% of the population that was eligible for that. Is that still roughly the same?
I think it's close to 6%, if I remember the most recent numbers. I'll have to double-check on it.
Okay.
But I think whether it's 3% or 6%, it's not a very large percentage of eligible families.
And again, that's like some the absolute most expensive care that you can try to access because of the, you know, the ratio that you have to have when children are under two, for instance. And so there, from the Head Start point of view, there's very little, really, that we can, I mean, for those that get it, it's a partial solution. But even for those who get it and are in a half-time situation, you have to think about if the families are really trying to have a full-time job, where do they go in those other hours? So that's, again, why child care is such a critical piece of this whole.
And I think this is a really important point about hours and what meets the needs of working families. One thing I would point out on that is we have had a really strong collaboration between our Head Start program and our employment-related daycare so that a number of Head Start programs are able to use that additional funding to make it closer to the hours of working families and the days of working families.
Right.
But that's for some programs and clearly doesn't meet the needs of all eligible working families.
Yeah. Any other questions on Head Start before we go?
Thank you. The 6% you just mentioned out of those who are eligible for Head Start or the early Head Start 6% served, is that because of lack of funding to serve more or lack of pursuit of Head Start?
That's lack of funding. So every Head Start program in the state, both the program for 3 and 4 year olds and for infant toddlers, has a pretty extensive waiting list.
Okay.
So we know that there are families ready and interested that if there were the resources would want those services.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going off your presentation here, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, but so the majority of children, so for the early childhood program, it's what is the age category that serves the early childhood program? What is the age?
So the early learning division.
Early learning.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Taylor, members of the committee, we serve children from the time they're born until they enter school.
Okay.
And then the age range depends on the program. So early Head Start serves children from birth until age 3. Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Head Start serves 3 and 4 year olds. Healthy Families serves infants and toddlers, so 0 to 3. It really depends on the program because they're designed for particular points in a child's development.
And in fact, early Head Start can enroll prenatally to really also help on those important health services beforehand for birth.
And then for child care, which we're talking about today, child care that's supported by the division actually serves young children all the way into some of the early grades of elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
So the Child Care Development Fund, which David will talk about, actually does have some school age funding that goes along with it too, because it's designed again as a working family support. So we serve infants and toddlers, we serve preschool age kids, and some of our federal funding also goes to support after school care for school aged kids.
Okay, I can ask my other questions later, I guess. Thanks.
You're welcome to ask.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Well, Representative Kenny Geyer got me very excited about Head Start because it's one of my favorite things, so I don't want to diminish from the great work of the state as well. But Head Start has taken tremendous hits at the federal level. It's federally funded, and so I'm really sorry to hear how low the service numbers are now. But the other piece to the Head Start program is the involvement of the parents, or generally, oftentimes, it's a single-parent household. But getting them engaged in the work of Head Start with their kids, but also there's employment training, there's skill building, there's the sense of pride and self-esteem. I actually, as a police sergeant, served on their policy council, mm-hmm. and to see them just again grow. So we're not only are we helping those children from birth on, we're finding employees for people. We're finding jobs that are people that can take some jobs and be very self-sufficient. And that's what I like about, again, the state's program as well. It's that collaboration. It goes, it's those sometimes unquantifiable things that we can't have in a report that really show some of the true values and just the great things that happen when we do the right thing and when we do it together. So thank you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Peloso, and members of the committee, I just want to emphasize what you just said. I actually just came from a group of Head Start parents, and one of them was talking about how she was a Head Start child herself. Her child was in Head Start, where she was a classroom aide. She just went and completed her bachelor's degree and is now working for the Head Start in her community. So nothing could underline your story better. I do think if there are no other questions, we'll let David go on. But please, this is very, happy to
one
have
one more
this
question.
Format.
Yeah.
One more question on the Head Start. So thank you. Mm-hmm. So correct me if I'm wrong. This is something I was told that I don't know if it's accurate on foster children. So two of my foster children were in Head Start. One of them, we were told that as soon as a child becomes a foster child, they immediately qualify because, you know, the income limits and everything, they qualify. And if that's accurate, please confirm that for me. The next question is, out of the percentage of children that we have in Head Start, what percentage of those vacancies or those open spots are filled by foster children?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and members of the committee, that's correct on eligibility, and we will have to get you that percentage. That's not a number that we have off the top of our head, but we can get that for you. I would say by the end of the day today, but I'm not sure exactly when we'll be done, so by tomorrow morning at the latest.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the role that the division plays in childcare through licensing and monitoring of facilities and ensuring the health and safety of children. As was just mentioned, this includes not just care for kids before they get to kindergarten, but children in before and after school programs. And we like to sort of think about this as a kind of consumer protection for parents, you know, as part of our role around child care. Parents have the right to know when they entrust their child with a licensed child care provider that certain health and safety standards have been met, and it's our job to monitor facilities to make sure that's true and address complaints when they arise. In addition to ensuring the basic health and safety standards are met, we also support and encourage providers to provide environments and experience that promote positive child development and contribute to school readiness. This includes work around the professional development system. So we're really in charge of creating an early childhood development system, and that includes both working with community colleges and other institutions around degree programs and also in-service training. The Child Care Resource and Referral Networks, which in addition to helping parents and find child care, offer technical assistance and other supports to child care providers in their community. And initiatives like the Quality Rating Improvement System that I'm going to talk about some more. And I think it's also just really important to note that child care providers are for the most part small businesses, and so the work that we do in supporting them is also an important to supporting the local economy. Now, I don't want to get into this in too much detail, but the world of early care and education can seem pretty confusing because it's full of all different kinds of formal and legal types of settings. But as Megan said in her presentation, early learning happens in a lot of places, and it's more important what experiences children have than where those experiences take place. But because it does impact our work, I did want to walk you through some of the different different kinds of child care settings. For licensed child care, we have our child care centers. Those are, you know, located usually in a business location, but and these can be a mom and pop business. It could be a national chain. It could be run by a nonprofit. It could be a for-profit business. But in addition to child care centers, a lot of licensed child care takes place in provider's own home. So when we talk about family child care, that's what we're really talking about, and that really is two different categories, up to 16 children in provider's own home, registered family child care, up to 10 children in provider's own home. And with these different categories, of course, come different regulations and requirements, and there's also particular rules about ratios depending on the size of the children, et cetera. But these are the basic types of licensed child care. In addition to licensed child care, Oh, sorry. So this also just gives you a sense of how many different kinds of child care facilities there are in the state. I put this up in part because if you look at our organizational chart, you'll see that about 75% of our employees are in the Office of Child Care, and that's because of that role in actually monitoring and licensing child care facilities that requires a lot of people all around the state to go into 4,320 licensed child care facilities on a regular basis. In addition to licensed child care, there are also a number of categories of statutorily licensed exempt child care, and these are just three of the, I think, primary examples. Family child care providers serving three or fewer children, preschool serving 3 and 4 year olds for fewer than 4 hours per day, child care facilities operated by a government agency. And of these three types, the family child care providers are really a very significant portion of the workforce that is taking care of our children in the state. And this is something that I think Rhonda will also probably touch on a little bit more in her presentation.
David,
a
little question.
Thank you, Chair. I just, going back to the previous slide, can you tell us how many kids are being served by those different types of child care providers, just so that we have a sense of, what needs are being met, because obviously you're working really hard and you're doing a good job, and where the highest risk kids are and where we have work yet to do. Where is the need yet, and where should we start to think about how we're going to dedicate our resources?
So it's
kind
back,
of the general
so
idea of what
that previous slide.
Yeah.
You'll see that for 0 to 5, about 30% of kids are in informal care. To be honest, we have less exact numbers about the number of children in license-exempt care by the mere fact that it's license-exempt and it isn't part of the same regulatory system, but it's about 30% of all kids at this point.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Representative Taylor, and members of the committee, I would just add that what we can provide you with, and I imagine that Rhonda may even touch on this, is how many children are currently served by the employment-related daycare subsidy relative to how many would be eligible for it.
Okay.
So that's the hard number that we can provide. The rest is just estimates based on capacity of the providers that we license and the number of kids that we know are within that age group in Oregon. There's not a place where we collect all of their information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
And then the one thing I would add on this is we actually used to have a little bit more accurate information on this when we had the Oregon population survey, because really the only way to find out is actually to ask parents directly. So when that survey went away, our knowledge of some of our more detailed knowledge about the informal child care market disappeared.
Can you say why that went away? It was an annual thing?
I think it was biannual. It wasn't done by the division. I think that was I don't know the history of that well enough to speak to why that went away. I believe it was a funding decision.
Okay.
So I want to talk a little bit about the Federal Child Care Development Fund, because it really has a really deep impact in everything that we do in the state around child care. The Federal Child Care Development Fund provides financial assistance to low-income families to access child care so they can work, attend job training, or an educational program. It also provides funding to support the supply and quality of child care for all children and not just those in the subsidy program. And as should be no surprise, with a federal funding stream, it also comes with a fair amount of formal requirements and guidelines and guidance, and that's something that we're going to touch on a little bit later. So for the current biennium, we're receiving about $135 million from the Child Care Development Fund, And I think probably the most important takeaway from this slide is that basically we would have no child care system. We would have virtually no child care system in the state without that federal investment. 81% of the funds go to Department of Human Services to support employment-related daycare. The federal guidelines require at least 70%, so we're actually above that. So we as the Early Learning Division are the state administrator for the Child Care Development Fund, and then we have an agreement with the Department of Human Services, so we transfer those resources to support employment-related daycare. And I think it's probably about close to 90% of our funding for employment-related daycare is coming at this point from the Child Care Development Fund. As you can see, about 13% goes to quality supports and 6% to our licensing system. And these are all really very, very substantial investments of percentages of those investments in those programs. So we really are tremendously dependent on the Child Care Development Fund. I want to talk, though, a little bit more about some of the investments that we are, as a state, making in quality child care. But before I do that, I want to talk about what's meant by quality child care, because I think sometimes it can be a little bit both off-putting to sort of put that adjective in front of child care and can sort of seem a little bit opaque about what that really means. But I think in some sense, when you step back, what we mean by quality child care is both pretty simple in many ways, also pretty intuitive. It means that healthy and safe environment, you know, first of all, that basic sanitary rules are being followed, that there are fire exits and those basic parts that are really embedded in our licensing system. The most fundamental part, though, is really about the interactions between adults and children, warm and supportive caregivers. And this is may sound touchy-feely, but the research is also really convincing that that is really a key ingredient in supporting school readiness, developing strong social-emotional skills.
Representative Harris, you have a question?
So question on the kind of healthy, safe environment. You recently made, there have been recent changes regarding the use of marijuana in daycare and OMMP. Can you share with us a little bit about how that, what those new rules look like, and whether you think by administrative rule they go far enough? And I will clarify that. I have concern that if it is voluntary on the part of the licensee to come to you and say, hey, I have an OMMP card, and that you're taking their, you know, word, what is the enforcement piece that happens in terms of going out into daycares and doing inspections? Is it all complaint-driven, or are you actually, you know, making the effort to go in and look at that? It clearly came up here in Salem. It was definitely an issue, and ODE reported to me that they probably had another 6 or 7 people who voluntarily said, we are OMMP users in our household, and we've issued those folks daycare licenses. So I'd just be curious what those new rules actually do, and if you think, you know, they're going to go far enough.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish, and members of the committee, I'll take that question. Thank you for asking it. I'm glad that you did. So the Early Learning Council last week just made permanent rules related to medical marijuana use in licensed childcare, and in anticipation of having to deal with it coming July 1st, also recreational marijuana use in licensed childcare. So if you are a medical marijuana cardholder, you cannot have a childcare license in the state of Oregon. To your question about how we know, at this point, we have no way of knowing unless we get a complaint that somebody does and we're able to verify it or self-reported, and that's because the medical marijuana program records are protected and we don't have access to them. So our administrative rule that the council promulgated went as far as we were able to take it.
Just a comment.
Yep. Quick one, so, and then I know we.
Yep. So.
Want to run pretty soon.
So I am hoping this is an issue that I don't know if the bill is going to come to us or not, but OMMP is not protected by HIPAA. The underlying cause of why somebody's been prescribed is, but if they actually have a card, is not. And I would hope that we would give ODE the ability to actually reference that list as it makes licensure for anybody coming into the system and having license. So I hope you take that up and hope that, your agencies have to be neutral, and I appreciate that. So I hope you have your support. I can't do that.
Thank you for the question, and I appreciate the chance to get on the record with what the rule that we promulgated does.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't want to spend too much time on the slide, but as we talked about, fundamental to the quality of childcare sending is the adult taking care of the children, their ability to support the growth of that child, but also to provide an environment that's language and literacy rich, where there are books being read, there are singing, rhyming games, to provide experiences that are cognitive stimulating, whether that's playing with blocks or an opportunities for imaginative play that allow children to explore the world and their relationship with others. And also two-way communication with family, I think a fundamental part of also what we mean about quality. And that also really means that parents have an opportunity to find childcare providers that are culturally responsible and share their values. I mean, there's a really important relationship between of trust between parents and childcare providers that I think is really fundamental to this story. And this leads me into some of the work that we're doing to support quality early learning environments in the variety of licensed childcare settings. Thanks to the funding that we've received from the federal Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant, we've been developing the Quality Rating Improvement System, which you'll often hear referred to as QRIS. This is a voluntary system of supports to help programs do exactly those kinds of things that I was talking about on the last slide. It provides standards that research has demonstrated are associated with positive early childhood development. So, for instance, those warm, supportive interactions, they can only happen when group ratios are of a certain size. You know, so those are part of the standards that are about quality early learning experiences. But more than just about standards, it's also about providing supports for practitioners, financial supports, and then finally rating and monitoring, and also parent and consumer education are also parts that we're developing out of this. So the way that the quality rating improvement system works is that it has different levels, starting with licensing and moving to 3, 4, 5 stars. And I think what's really important about this work is that each level builds on the next in a natural progression. So the idea is that once you've reached one level, there's a clear pathway describing the next steps to strengthen your program even further. And next week, you'll hold a public hearing on House Bill 2015. And one of the things that House Bill 2015 does is it allows us to build a connection between QRIS and employment-related daycare. And I think this would provide additional incentives for programs to participate and do this work that we know is so important to school readiness, but also help us ensure that low-income families are really accessing these programs that have demonstrated this work. As you can see from this program, QRIS is still pretty new. We're still not much more than a year out from our initial field test, but as you can see from the number of programs and commitment to quality, those are programs that have signed on and are doing those initial portfolios. It is generating a lot of interest from the field, and we're really excited about that. But beforehand, I also want to touch on some new changes to CCDF rules, because these are really going to have some important impact on the work that we do. So in November of last year, President Obama signed the reauthorization of the legislation for Child Care Development Fund for CCDBG. Did a number of things. At a high level, one of the things it did is it strengthens the focus on child development in CCDF, so it affirms a lot of the work that we're already doing in the state. But it also added some new health and safety and monitoring requirements. I think the most significant one is that there is a new on-site monitoring requirement for license-exempt providers who are participating in employment-related daycare. So, you know, that's sort of currently about, over 3,000 providers. Rhonda will talk more about those numbers. When you factor in the sort of turnover over the year, it's it's an even bigger number of new facilities that we as the Office of Child Care will need to be going into those facilities and making sure that they're meeting those health and safety standards. So some real significant additional work. This is also referenced in House Bill 2015 and authorizes the Office of Child Care to do that work. This is something that the state is going to have to do no matter what happens to HB 2015. But what that does is just clarify our role, which is, I think, consistent with the current division of labor that we have with the Department of Human Services around child care and child care supports. And there's also some additional requirements around fingerprint and background checks, enhanced requirements for reporting information, and some additional training requirements that will be part of that.
Great. Thank you, David. I just want to make sure people know that House Bill 2015 that he referenced is the employment-related daycare bill that we will be hearing on Monday. We'll have a public hearing on it on Monday. That's a good segue to Rhonda.
So we're ready to hand over to Rhonda.
And we're going to do a little shuffle here real quick.
Thank you.
And for those who may not know Jill Gray, who is setting it up, she is the DHS Government Relations for Self-Sufficiency Programs, including ERDC. Are you gonna actually join the panel and introduce yourself?
No, I'm just Rhonda's assistant for today.
This is the person who you will be emailing for information when you want to contact DHS, and Robin Johnson, our committee administrator. Robin will be following up with an email to make sure you're all clear about where to issue requests, just so you have a face to a name.
Great. So good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Presnensky, and I'm the Child Care and Refugee Program Manager at Department of Human Services. And I also want to thank you all for inviting us to talk about employment-related daycare today. We're going to provide just an overview of the program, the purpose, eligibility requirements, how the program serves families, some information on our child care providers, and then also our program goals. The employment-related daycare program is one of the self-sufficiency programs within DHS. We work very closely with the Early Learning Division and also the Early Learning Division's Office of Child Care. ERDC has a dual purpose of promoting family self-sufficiency, so we help families stay employed, and also fostering healthy child development and school readiness, breaking the poverty cycle for the next generation. That is our goal. The number of temporary assistance for needy family cases transitioning to ERDC has significantly risen in the past year. The average over the last 10 years had been 244 families per month, and since the beginning of 2004, the average has increased to 400. More families are finding work, and childcare is crucial for retaining these jobs. ERDC gives families access to quality child care. We've seen a steady increase in the number of ERDC families that are choosing licensed care. We provide ongoing outreach and education to partners and community organizations. Our subsidies help very low-income families from a variety of cultural and linguistic backgrounds and urban as well as rural areas by providing the same opportunity to access quality care as other families with higher incomes and helping to reduce the achievement gap. Now I'm going to go over our basic program eligibility requirements. First thing, we need to have a caretaker that must be employed. We currently do not cover families that are self-employed. We cover single and two-parent employed families. The self-employment was a reduction that was taken in 2009, and at the time it affected over 200 families. And I will mention House Bill 2015 includes a restoration of the self-employment policy. Our income eligibility limit is 185% of the federal poverty level. So for a family of three, their household income has to be under $3,051. The family needs to have a child care need, and a child ages birth through 11. Now, we do cover older children if they have a care need due to behavioral, medical, or other needs. They can also receive subsidy care. Our providers have to go through an approval process with DHS, and this includes a criminal and protective services check, and I'll go in a little bit more detail as to what all we do in a minute. So here's some additional information on who we serve, how we serve, and what we help to achieve. One thing that I really wanted to share with all of you today was that we're currently serving only 20% of our eligible families. And on our caseload right now, 90% are single parents, and over 97% are on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is known as SNAP, or food stamps. Our parents are required to pay a portion of their child care cost, which we call a copay. The average copay is $193 a month. In 2012, as a budget reduction, we did have to increase our copays by 10%. Many of our families have work constraints. In an Oregon State University subsidy study that was completed several years ago, over two-thirds of our employment-related daycare families had more than one work constraint. This really limits childcare choices for families. Our parents are often working odd hours, weekends, or their schedules change from week to week. We do provide a higher child care payment rate for children with special needs. And David and Megan had talked about the child care resource and referral agencies. And DHS contracts with them, and they provide child care referrals, parent education, and also provider education to our families. Now I wanted to provide just a little bit of information on our caseload. The program budget has not been able to support the 2013-15 average caseload of 8,500 cases, and this is due to an increase in cost per case. And again, I mentioned families are using more licensed care, so our expenses have gone up. The cap was adjusted to 7,800, and the reservation list was activated on October 1st of 2014. We do have reservation list exemptions, which are listed on the slide here. We have for families that are transitioning off of the TANF program, they're able to apply, and if they meet all the eligibility requirements, they're put on the program. And also for families that have had a break in ERDC of less than 2 months. And then also if the family's eligible for a contracted child care slot in a high quality program, those are exemptions. This last year we added
Can you clarify, when you're exempt from the reservation list, that means you go to the top?
That means instead of going on the list, mm-hmm. you can go ahead and apply and we'll process your application.
Right. Okay.
So the two new items that were added, two new exemptions, is that we now, for domestic violence survivors, and so they're receiving a domestic violence grant, either currently or in the preceding 3 months, they would be able to meet that exemption requirement. And then also for families that are working with child welfare, and they're in a safety plan that includes child care as part of the plan, that's a new exemption that we added. Our caseload for December is now at 7,924 families.
Sorry.
Yes, thank you. Before we go too far into other slides, back a couple slides on the average copay of $193 per month. Mm-hmm. If that's what the parent is paying, what total amount is being paid for that child?
Right, and it would depend on what type of care they're using and where the provider lives. We have a rate structure that we use. I can tell you, though, that our cost per case is about $670, and I can get some additional information, maybe some rate charts for you.
A month. That's a month.
A month.
So they're paying roughly 25% or somewhere in that ballpark.
It would depend. And again, I can get some additional information to you and some rate charts. So depending on where the provider is located, there's a market price study that's completed by Oregon State University, and our rates are based on that study and through collective bargaining.
And also, just for clarification, when you say the licensed or higher quality care earns a higher subsidy from the department to the provider, correct?
Yes. So there's a higher.
So there's
level
an incentive to put
payments.
Your children in a higher poverty and mm-hmm. higher quality care.
But I'd be happy, Representative Stark. I'd be happy to send you some additional information and rate charts. I think that would be very helpful.
Thank you.
That'd be great for the whole committee.
Yeah.
And Representative Hayden, and then Bueller.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Gayer. I have a question on slide 5 or page 5 under what we help to achieve. One of those bullet points is parent education. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Right. So with our contracts with the local child care resource and referral, they provide information to families on quality child care and help refer them to necessary services in their area. And then also at DHS, that's one thing, you know, that we try to do, make sure that our staff have information on the importance of quality child care that they're able to give to parents when they come into our offices. And then part of the reauthorization that David talked about, there's a component with that around consumer education that's a lot more extensive.
Okay, and a follow-up question, if I can. Follow-up question to that steps back one more, getting into the Head Start program. I was looking for, in that slide presentation, under two big health concerns that I think we have in the state of Oregon is childhood obesity and oral health.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anywhere in the program that provides specific counseling on nutrition and dental oral health, brushing, flossing, that kind of thing, with direct interaction with the parent to educate them on that great need, to really get to the earliest possible prevention?
Yes. Chair Kenny Gayer, Representative Hayden. To go back to those early learning programs that we've talked about, in almost all of them, but I can speak directly to Head Start, both parenting education is really an important component of that. And I know that particularly Head Starts do a lot of work about connecting family, but both about supporting good nutrition habits and also connecting children and families to oral health. And actually, embedding good oral health practices is actually a significant part of Head Start performance standards. I would also say that as we sort of look at the quality standards as part of the QRS, part of it is also the role of also developing good health practices is also part of that work. So I think that's a strand that's really embedded in a lot of the work that we're doing. And to also talk about something that I haven't touched on is the new early learning hubs, which are really the effort to create regional coordinators of early learning services. And one of the things, what's really part of the really exciting work that the hubs have done, they're very new, but in the short time, is really building some new linkages between early learning and health, particularly the CCOs. And there's some really great local partnerships, particularly I can think of one in Yamhill, where actually the hub, the backbone organization for the hub, is also the local CCO, and actually they have a project going on right now about promoting oral health practices.
So one more question from Representative Buehler, and then we'll let you finish your slides, just so we can make sure that we give Chris enough time and try to squeeze in some quick questions at the end.
Thank you. Do you know what the average hourly wage is for a child care worker in the state of Oregon?
Representative Buehler, I don't, but we could definitely get that information for you.
Thank you.
I don't have those numbers at my fingertip, but it's very low. I mean, a really high percentage of our early childhood workforce is eligible for a lot of the family supports that we're talking about because the incomes are incredibly low. And I think one of the real challenges around the work in child care, particularly as we're also asking programs to do more because we know how important it is for early learning, for promoting positive child development, is we know that child care is a huge burden on working families, but we also know that the providers are really making very low wages, and so that's a real challenge.
Thank you.
Okay, so I will continue. So this slide just shows the federal poverty level, and again, for employment-related daycare, it's at 185% federal poverty level. I know recently there's been lots of discussion and concern around cliff effects. And cliff effects occurs when the family household earnings are close to 185% of the federal poverty level, but they're still eligible for employment-related daycare as well as the SNAP program. And when the increase happens, it puts the family over the income limit of 185. And so they lose their ERDC benefits, they lose their SNAP benefits, and the month after the benefits close, the family needs to pay the full cost of child care. So that can be a real hardship on families. And so we are going to provide some additional information to the committee soon. We'll get that to you, and I hope that's helpful. And then I also want to mention the new federal rules. And they're going to really be helpful for some of these families that would have experienced the cliff effect. So ERDC providers, we currently have over 5,400 providers who care for subsidy children. Most of these providers are small businesses, and they're employed by ERDC parents and are contributing members of local local communities throughout the state. This table shows the number of providers by type that are approved through DHS. There are two groups. We have our license-exempt providers, and these are ones that are not required to be licensed by the Early Learning Division, and they're usually a relative or friend of the family that's doing the child care. Then we have licensed providers, and these folks must be licensed by the Early Learning Division. And both provider groups that we have on this slide are represented by unions. SEIU represents our licensed exempt providers, and AFSCME represents our registered and certified family providers. Next slide shows children, the subsidy children that are in different types of care, and we have over 55% of ERDC children that are in licensed child care. 83% of infants and 68% of preschool kids are in licensed child care facilities. Our certified centers are caring for about 4,000 children, and our registered and certified family homes are caring for over 5,000 children. And now I wanted to talk just briefly about the goals of our program. And the number one priority for the subsidy system is ensuring that children are in the safest and healthiest environments possible under the law. And for our license-exempt providers, there is a thorough background check process, and this includes a criminal Child Protective Service database for case history and the sex offender registry. Health and safety standards for child care providers have been strengthened to ensure the safety, health, and well-being of children in care. Improvements affect families receiving ERDC as well as TANF jobs, child care program benefits. And we've worked very closely with the Office of Child Care to align our policies. Last year, pre-service health and safety training became mandatory for our registered and license-exempt providers. In addition, approved license-exempt providers must take a mandatory orientation within 90 days of becoming listed with DHS. The new CCDF rules have a goal of ensuring equal access to high-quality child care for low-income children and continuous quality improvement for providers. Tiered subsidy reimbursement is one of the methods recommended, along with increased provider training to achieve this goal. And this is another item, as David had mentioned, that is in House Bill 2015. We do outreach and consumer education, and that's done by the Child Care Resource and Referral, but then also at DHS we're doing that centrally as well as in the local offices. And we are collecting and analyzing data on the percentages of children in quality child care settings by race and ethnicity. The goal is to provide equitable service to families from all race and ethnicities. We're also working with DHS staff and partners to provide information on quality child care. And now I wanted to just highlight a few of the changes to the Child Care Development Fund rules. And these are additional ones from what David had mentioned earlier. The new CCDF law made significant revisions that will increase the continuity of child care services. And I will say it one more time, because I know David and Megan did, but it is so important because it provides better education, developmental outcomes for children, and it decreases stress and negative behavior for young children, and this really helps the parent and helps them continue in that job. The law also provides protection for working parents, and this is regardless of a change in work status. The new requirements include a 12-month redetermination, including continued eligibility despite temporary changes, taking fluctuations in earnings into account, and a graduated phase out of care. And it also provides more flexibility with a family's contribution or co-payment. The law also provides more flexibility and encourages coordination across programs. Many of our families are touched by other programs within DHS, and we really want the focus to be on the family, not just individual program eligibility. Before I close, I also wanted to provide an update on the ERDC budget note from the 2014 legislative session. House Bill 2051 required the Early Learning Division and Department of Human Services to convene a work group for the development of policy recommendations to modify the ERDC program to include working parents enrolled in post-secondary higher education. The final policy details and recommendations were provided to the September e-board. The e-board decided this should be further discussed during this regular legislative session. An OSU policy study found that ERDC parents often go from one low-paying job to the other. Recently, I met with about 30 parents in the Portland area, and I heard from them how they wanted to go to school. They wanted to go to the community college, take additional classes, get additional training so they could get a better job. They also shared how important it was that their child would be ready for school. The new federal rules and proposed state legislation provide us an opportunity to improve the subsidy program, to more effectively serve our families, and improve outcomes. And then I'll be happy to take any questions.
Great. Questions for Rhonda? Well, we will hear more then when we hear the House Bill 2015.
Yes. Thank you so much.
I'll just say that, you know, when you think about how families who are in poverty can try to cover the child care costs, for anyone who has tried to pay child care, there's not a business model that really works very well, because with a ratio of 4-1 for the younger children, providers wouldn't have a market for people who could actually afford what it costs. So very few people can actually afford quality child care without the subsidy. And they end up making so little. So when you go back to the slide that David presented early on, or maybe Megan, with the enormous amount of neurological development that happens in that first year of life, and so much of what we try to do is based on so much of that foundation, and yet we've got some of our lowest paid people, lowest in, you know, very little training, and because of the low pay, often quick turnover, which is a bonding attachment issue for the children, it's a huge dilemma. And, you know, the fact that ERDC only covers 20%, I think you said, of eligibility, and I know that the cost per person is going up as you try to improve quality and you try to incentivize that and you pay more, but it's a real dilemma. So, you know, whatever we can do to, and in the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget was not specific about ERDC, but there is additional money for early learning in early childhood, and ERDC is certainly a part of that vision because we know how critical that piece is. We also know that we're never going to meet the need. It's so expensive, which is why we try to go at it with other mechanisms, for instance, the child care tax credits. So that's why we're just having a, you know, informational meeting today on just laying out the challenge of child care. So any other questions for this panel? And I'm assuming, Rhonda, you'll be back on Monday when we hear the ERDC bill.
Yes.
That'd be great.
Thank you so much.
Sure. All of you. So do I close this information? We close that informational hearing. And I'm going to open another informational hearing and call on Christopher Alamak for an overview of tax credits, and specifically the child care tax credits.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office, and I was asked to come here and talk and provide just kind of an overview, kind of a teeing up, if you will, of this review process. To start that off, just perhaps by way of I've forgotten how to talk. By way of context, I think I'm okay. By way of context, I'm with the Legislative Revenue Office. We are part of the building. We're staffed primarily to the House and Senate Revenue Committees, but we do try to respond to all legislative information requests. And this tax credit policy process is still relatively new. In 2009, the legislature put sunset dates on all of the tax credits in the system. Thank you. And they were divided up into three groups so that every 2 years, roughly a third of the tax credits would be sunsetted. And so there was a process set up in 2011 and 2013 where leadership decided to send basically placeholder bills. They just extended the sunset date for 6 years to each of the policy committees. And then each of the policy committees would review the policy and then make any changes they deem necessary and then send them to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. The thing that's different this time around is that in 2013, a bill was passed that required a tax credit report to be created by LRO that focused on the 18 credits that are sunset this session. And we released that report to the Revenue Committee, House Revenue Committee, yesterday afternoon. It should be on our publications page. It should also be in OLIS right now. So what I was really going to do here, and there should be a handout in OLIS that I put together, just a couple of talking points. Again, just trying to talk about some of the context, and depending on how Chair Kenny Geyer wants to run the process, this is kind of the directive that we're getting from leadership in a very high-level sense. So the process, really, within the policy committee, to really hash out the purpose and the policy goal to be achieved by the tax credits. One of the challenges in putting together an analysis and review of the tax credits was to really evaluate whether or not a tax credit was achieving what it was intended to do. There needs to be as clear as possible a statement on what the purpose was or what the goals were. So in that report, I went back to the implementing legislation for each of the tax credits and tried to describe, in some sense, get a feel for at least, if not an official statement of what the purpose was, what some of the discussion and what the testimony was provided, by, at least by the proponents. And then also within the report, there's some context for direct spending programs. And I think you're getting a sample of that today. Presumably the purpose for a lot of these programs are, if not identical, they're very similar. And they're likely to serve different populations, and they may only be tangentially related. The degree of relationship may vary a lot. But that's really the spirit of it, is the notion that these tax credits are simply an indirect spending program. So rather than collecting the tax revenue and then having that in the general fund and having it available to the appropriations process, it's being kept by the taxpayers to begin with when they file their tax return. So within the context of the work done in the policy committee, the potential changes to better achieve the goals can really run the gamut. The tax credit can be deemed to be fine the way it is and then simply forward it on, you know, extend the sunset date and send the bill to the joint, to JTAX that way. It can be enhanced, it can be reduced, it can be modified in almost any possible way. But I think probably the best way to get there is to really think and deliberate about the purpose of what you're trying to achieve through that. And then that should, I think, provide some guidance as to how the tax credit should be modified. At least that's the theory anyway. We'll see how that lines up with reality. And then in the joint, in JTAX, the direction we're getting is that they will be the folks who are really concerned about paying for all of the tax credits. And just for more context, there's this pie chart here where the simple cost of extending the 18 tax credits will cost an estimated $64 million for the 15-17 biennium. And in the co-chair's budget, the amount of money that they've allocated to the tax credits is $14 million. So those are very different numbers. And the pie chart here just shows you which ones by category. So the child care ones account for just about half of that $64 million. So it's $30 million to extend the child care tax credits. And those are four credits. There's a federal, there's a child independent care credit that's tied to the federal credit. There's the working family child care credit, which is a refundable Oregon-only tax credit. There's a tax credit for employers who provide referral services to their employees, and then there is a tax credit for contributions to the Office of Child Care. So from a tax perspective or an economic perspective from that end, for these policies, you have two credits or two subsidies that go to the consumers of child care, one to employers, and then one to, I'll call it the regulation of child care. So it kind of runs the gamut of the child care process. The other thing I just wanted to touch on were resources for the committee. The first one is the tax credit report that I mentioned, so you can read that. That provides some background information. And then there is also the tax expenditure report, which is a pretty thick document. It's a companion to the governor's budget. It's found on the DOR website. And then attached in the document that I sent are some other supplemental pages of data that are produced by the Department of Revenue. There's some charts and different pieces of information that trying to get at some common requests for who claim these tax credits. And the last item I put on there was LRO, and that's this session, that's me. Primarily the, and that's another change for this time, because in conjunction with producing this report, our office got another FTE so that precisely during legislative sessions we would have somebody available to the policy committee. So my primary function this section is to attend as many policy committee meetings as I can and be available to answer as many questions I can and help you out in whatever way you would like. And that's different from the past, where we were so busy with the revenue committees themselves, we weren't really there. And that was a issue that we heard from the policy committees, like, oh, you know, this is great, we have these, but we need some staff time to flesh out some of the questions or try to get some answers. So that's a very quick contextual overview of the intent of the process. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
And I'll just add to that, my understanding is that so our part is to really wrestle with, is the tax, the issue that the tax credit is trying to address, is that still an issue? In this case, childcare. Is there a need to really support, you know, is our government support childcare? If so, you know, are these tax credits the way to do it? Because when we forego revenue, then that means we have less to spend on programs like ERDC. So, you know, is this getting at the issue of childcare in a different way than ERDC does? You know, and is this, and who's taking advantage of it, and is it doing the job that it's set out to? So those are our concerns as a policy committee. When it goes on to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, they have the job of looking at the more closely the financial mechanisms and where the money comes from. I mean, we will look at financial mechanisms too, and are there ways that we can tweak it? But a lot of ours is this meeting the need? Is it getting at the population that we want to get at? Those kinds of things. And then new tax credits actually go on to the revenue committee. Is that correct? That's where they're...
The new tax credits, Chair Kenny Geyer, I think that could be all over the map. I've been focused on these 18 credits so far.
Okay. And we will have others. We're starting with the four child care tax credits to look at, but we have ones that deal with disability and housing and other kinds of things that will come in front of us as well. So we'll kind of take them in chunks. That's our first intro. Are there questions about the process? So I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of a, because we've got your time here now, a little bit more of a preview of the different, we're going to need to hear it a couple different times, and I know that we're going to actually take these bills one by one on Friday, but I think if you give us, walk us through, you mentioned it in like a sentence about each, but maybe give us a little bit more, because then when we go back and read these, which I encourage people to do before Friday, because you'll be able to come up with more questions, it'll help us with a bigger context of each of these.
Sure. The first one in order, in no particular order, but there's the Child and Dependent Care Credit, which is tied to federal law. Federal law, there is a Child and Dependent Care Credit that allows a credit for expenses of up to, I believe I'm going off the top of my head here, I think $3,000 for one child or $6,000 for two or more children. So there's a cap on the eligible expenses, and the credit can be as high as 35% of those expenses.
And a dependent child means anyone up to a certain age for
yes.
a family with a certain income?
Well, it's the age is for the child, the dependent is 12 or 13, something like that, I think. And the credit, the share of the credit phases down. So as income goes up, you get less of a credit, but it doesn't phase out completely. So even, you know, even toward the top of the income scale, you can get a 20% credit. And a lot of states tie to that because a lot of the infrastructure and a lot of the definitions around eligible dependents and eligible expenses and so forth is in federal law. So it's from that sense, it's easy to piggyback on that one because we can just leverage the federal law. And so that one we have, and that's been in law for a while. It is not refundable.
So... This is not my area. So I'm going to ask questions, but I invite other people to, too. Does that mean that the feds set out what you can do, but the state is the one that decides whether to issue this as a tax credit, or is there also a federal tax credit on the federal income tax returns, and we go beyond that and do the same for our state tax returns?
Yes, and I'm trying to avoid any of the tax lingo. If I slip into that, please call me. So if somebody claims this credit, they will fill out their federal tax form. They're paying their federal taxes, and they will claim the federal tax credit against their federal income taxes. Mm-hmm. So that has nothing to do with the state. If a state offers their own child a dependent care credit, which Oregon does, mm-hmm. piggybacking on that law, we're basically tied to how that works. And roughly speaking, if you're eligible to claim the federal child independent care credit, then you can claim the state child independent care credit. States don't have to have that credit. That's determined by their own assemblies. So we have that in our law. And we have a different phase-out schedule. Mm-hmm. So we're tied to some of the definitions, so the eligible expenses. Mm-hmm. But we actually have a phase-out. So as income gets high enough, then you can't get the Oregon child independent care credit. And I will leave it at there. There's some really tax wonky definitions of income and so forth that come into play here, but broadly speaking.
And it's got nothing to do with child care then.
Right.
Just dependent care.
Right. I'm sorry?
This is for expenses for child care or not necessarily just child care?
Well, child and dependent care.
Child and dependent care.
Yeah.
Chair Kenny Geiger, thank you. So I'm looking at the charts here and looking at the graphs here, and they seem to be fiscally based into categories of health care, child care, disability, business investment, and financial independence. That's all good information. What I would like to see, and maybe it's here and I just haven't learned how to read it yet, so I'm open to that, is how many children are actually being taken care of, and what income level are those families or the children in those families coming from? When we talk about Head Start, they're talking about being able to fund 6% of the population. How many of those 94% of the population are taking advantage of this tax credit? That kind of concept. So we saw a lot of information in the first two presentations about here's the families and the kids, and I think we can all, I won't speak for myself, I think I can understand that maybe a little bit better than the bar graphs and the dollars and the cents, but I'd like to, if there's some way to see the end user a little bit better than just in dollar figures on federal tax, is that possible, or is that here and I just can't read it?
I'm trying to follow Chair Kenny Geiger, Representative Hayden. I'm trying to follow the question in terms of, you're trying to get at the number of children served or more information about the families?
Trying to get at the children that are served by this tax credit, that the parents, when they file their tax return, they take that tax credit, right? Mm-hmm. How many children is that, and at what income level are the parents taking that?
In the report, there is a, well, you just said bar graphs don't work for you, right?
No, go ahead.
In there, let me see if I can.
What page are we on?
I'm trying to find it here. So we look at the, well, I guess we were talking about the dependent care child credit.
Just for clarification, so I'm a little confused. This child and dependent care.
Do you know explicit? Pardon me.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair. My apologies. Do you know explicitly which bill this one refers to, that child and dependent care? Is that House Bill 2116?
Don't know.
It's okay. I'll look.
Three bills.
I'll look it up. Okay. I'll look it up.
You had the tagline or the ORS reference in there. Yeah, I wasn't.
Okay.
I didn't have the bill numbers.
It's totally okay. I'll look it up. I'll look it up. So give me one second. Okay.
So on page 52 of the report, there are a couple of bar charts.
Of the full report.
Okay. Yeah. And I should say this report isn't, it's really a work in progress, kind of as we get questions. I mean, part of the reason to be a resource is as questions come up is to try and gather the information to answer those questions.
It's a 101-page report. So I'm wondering if on the just child care, because we're going to have public hearings, so other people will come up and testify in favor against, but maybe you could take that child care tax credit report and just walk us through that document, the shorter document.
The shorter document.
the one that's just on the child care.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does everyone see that in OLAS?
I got to page 52. It does have income on there, but okay, yeah.
So the other, that's the long one that includes all the 16 tax credits and the whole way they're approaching it. This, then, he has a separate one for us here, which is just the child care tax credits, which are the ones that we're going to, that we're going to be looking at on Friday.
Okay.
Can you see that, find that in OLAS?
That's a seven-page document?
Yes.
If you get to page, I think it's page two, is the child and dependent care credit.
I have not found that.
Okay, this one?
Yes.
Go ahead and jump to your
Okay.
email. Down here.
So why don't you walk us through that one at a time?
Okay. So the first part there, and this is a document that's actually produced by the Department of Revenue.
Uh-huh.
The credit history there, so you have the number of people taking the tax credit between 2005 and 2012. So it's about, it was
going
about
down.
50,000 down to about 40,000. And the revenue impact each year, so this is the cost, was about $8 million, and it fell. So it's about $7.5 million a year. And then the revenue impact percent of tax revenue. Well, I'm going to skip that one. That's kind of wonky a little bit. But the credit used by income category, this might get at Representative Hayden's question. So we have the income group by full year filers. So you have below 12,400. So there were 2,010 taxpayers claiming the credit who had income below $12,400.
Okay.
And that's 0.6% of those filers claiming the credit.
The color coding on the site, I'm sorry. The color coding doesn't match the first page, right? The categories in your graph.
Correct. So, yeah.
Okay.
I produced the larger document, and this came from the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
And so that gives, so you can see that if you get up to income for families with income between 46,000 and 81,000, you have 4.4% of the filers claiming the credit. Now that's total filers. That's not necessarily filers with children. Or even children of eligible age.
And can you explain what are employment-related dependent care expenses besides child care? What else is included in that? Would it be transportation, taking children?
I believe, are you talking about for the ERDC program?
No, not for ERDC. I'm just assuming for this tax credit that you can
expenses necessary to get you to be employed. So if transportation, I think, would be part of that. It's whatever expenses you need to incur to be employed.
Okay.
Like a car?
Yeah.
No, I'm not sure. I'd have to get back to you and do a little more research on. I don't know that car payments would be part
That's
of that.
Something that you can provide for us by Friday?
I can try.
Okay. All right. And can you explain why it may have gone down, the number of people claiming this? Any guesses as to?
I don't know. I'd have to look at that. I'm not sure. Because I don't think that, I don't know offhand why it would have gone down.
Okay.
I mean, in 07 and 08 and 09, I mean, it could all be all recession-based. As we headed into the recession years there, and it just hasn't bounced back yet. That's possible.
So as people lost jobs, they were no longer eligible for this.
As they lost jobs, they didn't need the child care.
Right. Okay. And do you have to itemize on your tax returns in order to get this?
No, the credits are dollar-for-dollar reductions of tax.
Mm-hmm.
So the standard or itemized deductions, that is income that would not be subject. Basically, those reduce the income subject to tax.
Okay.
So once you figure out what your gross tax liability is, so after all deductions and everything, you have your taxable income,
mm-hmm.
you multiply by the tax rates, and then you have what we call your gross tax, and then whatever credits you're eligible for reduce that dollar for dollar. So a $100 tax credit reduces your liability $100.
Right. So if you're making $32,000 and you can claim $10,000 in expenses, then your taxable income is $22,000. You get to take it right off the top.
Yes.
And that's what you're taxed on. That's right. What all of these credits are, correct? Well, not all of them, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just the ones for family income.
Right. I'm not sure. Wait. I'm sorry.
Well, it's not true for employer base, so sorry. But for this one, it's a tax credit for expenses right off the top of your taxable income.
Right. No, off the tax.
Off the tax liability.
So if you're making $32,000 and you have $10,000 in expenses.
If you have $32,000 of gross income and you have deductions of $10,000, then your taxable income is $22,000.
Right.
You multiply that by the tax rates of 5, 7, and 9.
Right.
And just to be very simple with the math, going with a 10% tax rate, then $22,000 at a 10% rate is $2,000 of tax. And then this would reduce, and if you had a $100 credit here, that would reduce the tax by $100.
So we have kind of three options if we're sponsoring bills around trying to use the tax code. Mm-hmm. A deduction, which tends to be if you have you take the standard deduction or you take your itemized subtraction. So like there's one for military family, it comes right off the top. So if you're, Oregon taxable, like the AGI coming over from your federal tax return minus the subtraction, and then you start deducting and tax credits at the end. It's like this is like the political tax credit. You get it back dollar for dollar on your tax return, and then there's subtractable or refundable tax credits. So some of them are like you didn't have to actually pay it, and the state's just going to give you money, and then some of them just, get you to break even on your taxes. So
in very rough math, in terms of value, a $100 credit is about the same as a $1,000 deduction.
Say that again.
This isn't technically accurate, but going with round math just to convey the concept, a $1,000 deduction is equivalent in value to a $100 tax credit. A $1,000 deduction, and where I'm getting that is a $1,000 deduction times a tax rate of 10% is $100. So roughly, and because we don't have a 10% tax rate, I mean at the top it's 9.9, but so I'm trying to convey a spirit, not be technically accurate.
Okay. So then you have where most of the people who are getting the tax credits live.
Yes, there's a table by income category, by age of primary filer, and then some geographic information.
Question? And child tax credits are not refundable credits, right? They are not.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish, the child and dependent care credit is not refundable. Mm-hmm. The working family child care credit is refundable.
Okay.
So in the manner in which I group these, those two credits are credits that go directly to the consumers of child care. And so you have two credits that do largely the same thing, and there are some differences between the two. And a refundable tax credit, to try and come up with an example, that basically, if my tax liability, my gross tax liability, my taxable income times the rate is $200, and I have a $250 credit that is non-refundable, then my tax gets reduced to zero and I don't owe anything. But in some sense, I lose $50 of that tax credit because I couldn't use it to offset my liability. I didn't have enough liability. If this $250 credit were refundable, then I would actually get $50 back from the state. So that's a key difference. And part of the reason the refundable credits are used in the tax code is to get at the lowest income people who don't have sufficient income to have a tax liability. And this is one of the areas where some will argue that the link between the tax code and the indirect spending gets to be nearly identical to direct spending programs because you have a person who didn't have sufficient income and, or for whatever reason their deductions and their credits offset all of their liability. If they are eligible for a refundable credit, they can get a check from the state. Mm-hmm. And it's not a maybe I'll stop there.
Question? Yeah. Chair Kinnegar, can you please explain to us how it works when someone is divorced and single and how it makes it so that we know, has the responsibility shared when they're divorced or if it's just one person but we're, you know, garnishing someone's wages to help pay for that so that if one of the two parents is actually filing and perhaps the other parent is not filing? Do you see what I'm saying? And so if we had, and then also with divorced families, how is this, because we have more and more families that are choosing for whatever reasons to not get married, and then we have this child care issue. And I'm just wondering how the tax credits are being structured.
Chair Kinnegar, Rep. Taylor, well, and this is where I wish the Department of Revenue was here.
Sorry to put to this.
Because they deal with these administrative issues on a regular basis. And it's my understanding they will be here more in the future when actual bills are up. So I'll take a stab at it with subject to a potential revision.
Yeah.
But the credit should go to the person who is incurring those expenses. And in situations where you have a divorce, they might be able to agree that this person, only one person gets to claim the credit. It's like at the federal level, I believe in cases of divorce, there's an agreement that one person gets to claim the dependents as an exemption on their tax return. They don't necessarily have to live with them that whole time, but it can be part of the divorce.
Mm-hmm. And if they're not married and they have a child together?
I think it would still go back to who's incurring those expenses. But that really gets into the weeds of the definition of a dependent, and that's where I would need to get more information.
What custody cases usually decide those things?
So another question on this child independent care. It ranges from 4 to 30% of eligible expenses based on federal taxable. So you get a larger percent as your income is lower, and then the percent that you're given in the credit goes down as your income goes up?
Yes.
So for the lowest income, they get 30%, basically. And for the highest income, up to $45,000, they get 4%.
Correct. And then above $45,000. And I included that table in that larger report. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as income goes up, they get a smaller percentage.
Okay. And maybe this is not a question for you, maybe it's Friday. It's like, is this doing what it intended to do? We'll hear a public testimony on that. I don't know that you want to offer any opinions, having gone back and looked at what it was supposed to do, how many people they thought would be on it.
What was it supposed to do?
I guess that's in the longer report, because it doesn't say it here, but you do say in the longer report.
Well, I take Chair Kinnegar, I try to take a stab. I go back to the original implementation.
I think it's in the 101-page report, which I haven't looked at.
And in some respects, it helps offset the cost of child care. So this is where it can be somewhat tricky or maybe nuanced in terms of evaluating it. Well, if you get a credit for child care, then it achieves the purpose. It offsets the cost of child care. The other deeper questions could be whether or not if the committee wanted to tie the value of the credit to certain kinds of child care or the quality of child care. In the prior presentation, I'm learning a lot about the direct spending programs because that's not my area. But if presumably going by market forces, more expensive child care is better child care, and if the tax credit enables people to afford more expensive care than they would have done otherwise, then one could argue that it is helping improve the child quality, the quality of the child care that people are receiving. They are not easy questions to answer. And the first step is really, well, what was it supposed to do? What is it that we wanted, what the legislature wanted the credit to do?
Okay.
In the back of the 101-page report?
Yeah, which we sent out. Ty and I sent this out today to the whole committee.
Right, and it's also on OLIS.
Yes.
But in the very back, Appendix D shows the committee policy questions. What's the public policy purpose of the credit? Who's benefiting? What is expected to happen if this sunsets? Are there other ways to get at helping families with child care that are better than this?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, please.
In the longer report, which is on OLIS and we sent out to you today, the credits are pointed out very explicitly, and they're just short, almost like one pagers on each credit.
Mm-hmm.
So that are very descriptive. Mm-hmm. So that's a resource that's available to the committee as you go away and prepare for Friday. And we'll send out Chris's contact information, even though it's also on OLIS, in case anyone has any specific questions for him. That's something we can offer to the committee as a resource.
Thank you. And to give you a sense of where this is going, we will open this up for public testimony for all four of the tax credits on Friday, and then we will not have a working session on it for 10 days later, Monday. So there's a lot of time for us to absorb this and try to figure out where we're going with this, especially because it's our first set of tax credits that we're looking at. Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's LFO, but the fiscal kind of responsibility of to the state of just even implementing these programs, so not the tax credits and the actual benefit to the end user, but there's an administration cost to all of this. And one of the things I think we should consider as we try to think about, is this the most effective delivery, is what is the most expedient delivery that provides the most flexibility to the consumer who needs the child care, mm-hmm. that reduces administrative costs to mm-hmm. the state, so that those administrative costs can actually be rolled into programmatic costs that are being delivered to the taxpayer. And I don't know if you have any data around the administrative costs of either of these. Obviously, tax credits and things are going to be a DOR issue when you're filing your tax return, and you know the audit process maybe evaluates that. But certainly on the other side of employment-related daycare program, there is a direct administrative cost to make that happen. And I'm just curious if, you know, you have that data or LFO has that data in, or how we get that data. But then just for the whole committee, I mean, I think we really have to have a conversation about what is the most effective way to administer so that the money is not going to internal constituent, it's going out to the community where it needs to be.
Chair Candy Geyer, Representative Parrish. That's a good point for a couple of reasons. One, the report, the intent of the report was to include administrative cost information. The report is kind of thin on that at this point. And within these credits, a lot of times the administrative cost for the state, for the tax credit, is what we would call marginal. There are 60 tax credits, and to ask the Department of Revenue how much does it cost to administer this tax credit for them, it's processing and an auditing function. And so you take away any one of those credits, and there isn't necessarily a large budget savings at that level. Having said that, with the Child Independent Care Credit and the Working Family Care Credit, those are two very different things. One of them leverages federal law, so there aren't a lot of administrative costs there, whereas the Working Family Child Care Credit, there actually are a fair amount of administrative costs. And I have been talking to the Department of Revenue, and they are gathering that information. I don't know if they'll have it by Friday, but they are working on that. Because it is an Oregon-only tax credit, they bear the full cost of administration. Now, there are other tax credits not within this committee where those administrative costs are borne by a different state agency. So depending on how the tax credit is structured, the administrative costs can be borne by the state, but it'll depend on which agency. But on this one, they are working on trying to get that and figure out the people that they have on that to administer it. And so that is one that has more administrative costs than usual for tax credits.
Question? Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, for getting us starting to get us all educated on all of this and arranging for all of this so that we know what we're doing and getting some information before we make these important decisions. But I just want to say this publicly and so get some feedback so that when we have the information that starts to come in connected to the bills, I just want to make certain that there is not an unintended consequence of somehow there being a bias for if a woman has a child out of wedlock versus a woman who's married or divorced, because usually it's the women who are bearing the responsibility of the child care and making decisions and weighing all of this, not to say hopefully their partners are involved, but I just want to make certain that it's fair across the board. That's all I want to make certain at the end, that there isn't an unintended consequence, that somehow there's a benefit if you're married, divorced, or single or something like that. So
I'm not aware. Nothing comes to mind.
Uh-huh.
The filing status, the person would be filing single as opposed to joint.
Right,
so
but we could
sure
also be making certain that if there is another person involved in that child's life, that they're also helping to share the responsibility and that we're making certain that all of that is factored in.
Oh, okay.
You see what I'm saying? We want to make certain that there's two people generally, if possible, to have both of them
right
helping with the responsibility across the board, and that they do get the services. The child gets the most that's available to them, not just from the state, but from
right
both their parents. So.
So maybe we can get to the next one, and you can just walk us through that and
sure
tell us how it's different. You've said that it doesn't have the federal, it's more expensive to administer. And it looks like it's got something on interest, dividends, and capital gains as that didn't show up in the first one, so I'm trying to understand the difference between the two.
The difference here in, this is an Oregon-only one, it's been in law since 1997, and it was made refundable in 2003. And the focus, the reason there's a limit on unearned income, in some circles, income gets divided into two groups, earned income and unearned income. Earned income will be wages or from a business. Unearned income is interest, dividends, and capital gains. So the idea here was to focus the credit toward people who were basically taking that unearned income out of the equation. And there's actually a cap. If you have too much unearned income, then you become ineligible.
If you have too much
unearned mm-hmm income, again, to focus on the working poor.
Mm-hmm. And how did it get treated in the first one, the child independent care? How does unearned
income was just income. It wasn't singled out. I don't think it was singled out.
But it does count toward the income.
It counts as income.
Counts as income.
And I'll do a little research to see.
Yep. So can I clarify that on the how we treat the income? Because when I I was self-employed and still had my children in daycare, and my husband was a W-2 earner. And when we would file our tax returns, we were limited in how much of the daycare we could deduct because my income as self-employed, on a K-1 as an LLC, didn't count towards those levels in terms of how much I could deduct of child care. So is this kind of what we're talking about here? That because I ended up, not being able to, had my income been W-2 income, I would have been able to deduct more of my child care on my Oregon state tax return, and that seemed to be kind of problematic. So am I?
You were talking about deductions that you can take at the federal level?
No, both apply both at federal and at state level. Is there so for self-employed people who are taking, state deductions for child care, are they limited by whether or not that income is W-2 versus self-employment income? Because I seem to, now that we're having this conversation, and I don't pay child care anymore, but mm-hmm I seem to recall not being able to fully deduct my child care years ago as somebody who had K-1 income from an LLC.
That doesn't ring a bell. I'll have to look into that.
Okay.
To get that.
So my quick read of this is that it's got tighter eligibility, that it says that you the child care expenses have to be those necessary for the taxpayer to be gainfully employed. That wasn't, it seemed looser on the first one. Am I reading that correctly? That seems to be a difference.
Yeah, I think when this was debated in the legislature in 97, they didn't get rid of the other credit, so this was to be an add-on. I think they wanted to make it a little stricter.
And do you have a sense of why they even created something like this when we already had a different program? What was the issue that it was trying to address? It's more targeted toward child care specifically related to employment?
I think so. More targeted and refundable. And when it was put in place, I believe I'd have to confirm the records. I think the idea was to make it refundable, but the cost was too high. Mm-hmm. And so when it was originally put in place in 97, it wasn't refundable. But it also gives one of the advantages of this credit over the other credit, it cuts both ways in terms of administrative costs and leveraging federal policy, is that for an Oregon-only credit, mm-hmm. there's more flexibility in deciding how all of the parameters of that policy mm-hmm. within the state.
And is there somewhere here that says what the average that people actually get off of their taxes, what the credit actually ends up coming to? Is there a column that I'm not noticing? Like, what's the average tax credit for the first one versus the second one?
The second one is $852. It appears in a couple of places. Okay. And on the first page in the income group by full year filers, kind of the column to the right of the blue bars, there's average revenue impact of the credit. So it's $852 for the working family and $188 mm-hmm. For the child and dependent care credit.
And can you only can qualify for one or the other?
No, you can claim both. And so that's another aspect to this in terms of a policy consideration, since you're eligible for both. That's another piece of a more complete picture. And then some of the charts in the larger report, mm-hmm. I have a couple of graphs that show people claiming one or the other or both. And just for some context, there were about 27,000 people claiming the working family child care credit in 2012, and just about 43,000 claiming the child and dependent care credit. And there were 25,000 claiming both. So 25,000 of the 27,000 claiming the working family credit also claimed the child and dependent care credit. Offhand, I don't know what happened to the other 2,000 mm-hmm. filers who didn't claim the federal one. I don't have an answer as to why they wouldn't have claimed that.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm no tax expert, but when I look at the working family credit, an example of a time when someone would no longer be eligible for this credit is, say, they sold a house mm-hmm. and they profited from that house, and that ends up being capital gains profit. And because of that, they may not have worked or may have worked very little. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of could disqualify. Actually, I had that happen mm-hmm. last year. So I was typically would have qualified for these. And because of a small piece of property, mm-hmm. it cut me out for the working family child care.
But not for the first one.
Correct. So and so it's a matter of one is just what's your overall income mm-hmm. and the other one makes sense on if you're an investor, it's a matter of trying to make sure you're going out to work every day as opposed to a bank account that's making you money, and so you're staying home and also receiving this credit. So that was my understanding of it. You can correct me if I'm off on something, but just a little bit on it.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, I'll take your word for it. That's what happened. I'm a little bit surprised because when you sell a home, usually that gain doesn't show up on the tax return.
It was an investment property.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
But so.
But.
Real big
that could be an example of a policy area where you may want to change.
So another question I have is that the first one, the credit is not allowed for incomes over $45,000, but it says percent of filers in the income group taking credit, so 4.4 of them were over $45,000.
So which one are we? Are you looking
on the first one?
The first one.
It's capped at incomes over $45,000, but when you look at the income groups halfway down the page, the income group that's between $46,000 and $81,000, 4.4% of the people who claim this credit came from that category.
It's on the second page of the short handout.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a table I want to put my finger on. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This would happen to have to happen on the first day. There are different definitions of income.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. The income isn't always income. The table that's put together by DOR, I believe, is going to be part of the problem is I didn't put that table together.
The same thing happens on the working family, but a smaller percent, 1.2% are over
46,000.
Yeah, some of the phase-outs can happen at AGI, and if they get reported by a different definition of income, people can show up in different slots, if that makes sense. The first one, the Child and Dependent Care Credit, is phased out for at $43,000 of federal AGI. And depending on the definition that they use to produce this report, that could be Oregon AGI, and that could be a different number. Because the way the tax code works is while we start with federal, mm-hmm. the Oregon tax system starts with federal taxable, mm-hmm. federal AGI. And then we add certain income that the feds don't tax, and then we take away other things. Those are called additions and subtractions.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be taxpayers who can have a low amount of federal income, but they might have a lot of Oregon additions.
Mm-hmm.
And I can dig into exactly where some of these are coming out, and it'll be easier to convey with an actual example.
Okay. So. Examples would be great.
So when you say, just for clarity, when you say subtractions and things that the feds count, but we don't. Does that typically where we always get in the conversation? It seems like every 2 years on the reconnect issues of trying to match Oregon's tax codes to federal tax codes, and we seem to get a bill on that issue. Is that and when we don't do that could skew those income? I think that's how
that's part of it. That touches on a lot there, and there's another bill this session.
Yes.
To reconnect.
Sure there is.
The larger context is that according to the Oregon Constitution, the legislature can't cede any authority to another body. One exception to there is taxable income. And so there are two pieces to tying to federal law. We have tying to federal law in terms of the definition of taxable income, and then we have other provisions that we have to tie to a specific date. And the definition of taxable income, well, in the past, sometimes we disconnect from that. Right now, we have what's called rolling reconnect, where anytime Congress changes something that affects federal taxable income, it automatically affects us. Bonus depreciation is a contentious issue, and Congress just passed an extender's bill dealing with federal depreciation. That automatically lowered federal taxable income, and because of the rolling reconnect, it also lowered Oregon tax revenue. And so it's all tied together in terms of how we define the income.
Okay, well, we've hit our limit, so I am going to close the informational hearing on the tax credits, child care tax credits, and we are now adjourned. For this session?
We're good.
Adjourned. For this session?
We're good.
We're adjourned.